This this evening's Dhamma talk, I just wanted to offer a few reflections based on the Bakula Sutta, which we studied a little bit yesterday, and just to just reflect about some of the issues which were raised there. Not so much in terms of the nitty-gritty of the details of the text, which we looked at in the Sutta class, but more in terms of the sense of meaning or orientation that the figure of Bakula provides in some way, and the questions that that raises for practitioners of the Dhamma, and especially for those of us who are intent on the monastic way of practice. And when we looked at the sutta, I pointed out that as well as the actual text, the Bakula Sutta, we also had a number of other sources, mainly the few verses in the Theragata, and then the verses in the commentaries. And as so often happens in these cases, we had almost like a historical sequence from the verses in the Theragata, which seemed to me to be completely unproblematic from any historical point of view, very straightforward Dhamma teachings, to then the description of Bakula in the Majjhima Nikaya, which raised a number of difficult problems historically, and then finally to the commentarial account of Bakula's life, which seemed almost entirely drawn from very primal mythic archetypes rather than having any historical basis at all. So this is a fairly normal kind of spectrum in such studies. So as a historian, we might be interested to look at actually who the figure of Bakula was and so on and so forth, but as somebody who's interested in the meaning of the holy life and the meaning of practice, the mythological origins of Bakula are also very interesting, and particularly the way that the commentaries interpret his name as Bakula, meaning two family, and of course the two family referring to the fact that he was abandoned or lost as a child, swept away by the river and then brought up by another family other than his birth family, of course being a retelling of the classic Jonah and the whale, or the Moses and the bulrushes, and many other myths. The coming out of the river is a classic image of rebirth. So he's been born twice with two sets of parents, and hence the Bakula. Of course, such archetypal images have a variety of possible meanings and interpretations. But typically, the basic meaning of that motif is it's a way of expressing a person's dual nature, that is, the divine and the material, or the sacred and the profane. So in a sense, it's an expression of that part of our nature, one part of our nature which, if you like, faces upwards and is drawn to what is higher, drawn towards transcendence, drawn towards what is divine. And the other part of our nature which is, if you like, drawn downwards, drawn back into the earth, drawn back into the body. And typically when we have heroes of this sort, which actually in mythology is almost all of the heroes, we find that one of the sets of parents is in some way divine, while the other one is human. So that nexus of facing two ways, facing upwards or outwards or beyond to some spiritual ideal, and also being drawn back, drawn down into the material world. It's a very normal situation for anybody who's practicing the spiritual path. It's a situation which, if we don't handle it well, can cause various kinds of problems. We can create an excessive dichotomy between the spiritual and the worldly, cutting off the engagement in any sense with the lower aspect and only looking upwards. And that, of course, can be quite dangerous. Ajahn Chah said of the Western monks that they know everything about what's up in the sky, but they don't know what's underneath their feet. And I think that's a very lovely way of putting that. What's underneath our feet is also part of it. And we can see in that story of Bakula that there's very much that kind of deprecation of anything underneath the feet, anything which is in the slightest bit worldly, he wouldn't be associated with requisites, cloth, food, and especially, of course, women. And in mythic or archetypal imagery, the woman typically is associated with those forces of the earth, forces of creation, generation, the material side, whereas the masculine is typically associated with the light, with air, with consciousness, and so on. So I'm not trying to draw any particular conclusions about the differences between men and women here. I'm just describing how these qualities tend to be used in most mythologies. Whether rightly or wrongly, I'm not to say whether that's accurate or inaccurate or useful or not useful. Or it's just something that I've observed. That's how these things tend to go. So in the Bakula Sutta, there's very much a disparaging, a deprecation of all of those worldly things. It's not even putting a stitch in a robe, not even looking at the face of a woman. So there's this strong separation, almost division, between that worldly and that spiritual side. So again, I'm not meaning or trying to do a historical account of what that means for Bakula as a person. I think we know so little about him as a person that it's a bit foolish to try to say too much about who he was and what these things meant for him and to what extent any of them might be true. But I'm just trying to look at what these things mean in an ordinary world context. So of course then there's the other extreme, and that's an extreme which, or not an extreme, but rather tendency, which is the tendency that is quite predominant in modern forms of spirituality, which is to reintegrate that upper and the lower, reintegrate the spirit and the matter. Picking up, for example, in Buddhism from statements attributed to Nagarjuna, such as that Nibbana and Samsara are the same, although a more accurate rendering of what Nagarjuna was actually saying would probably be something like the first point of Nibbana would be the first point of Samsara would be the first point of Nibbana, which is a slightly more subtle thing. So then there's this tendency to deprecate the separation of the spirit and matter. So and that's accompanied, for example, by things like, say, a more secular lifestyle. Yeah? So rather than thinking that you need to be a monastic set to live in a way that's separate from worldly concerns, then one can live in the world, be mindful in what one's doing, and integrate one's spirituality in one's sexual relations, and so on and so forth. So this is like another tendency or trend which is quite strongly felt in modern Buddhism. And of course I think a little reflection would, not just modern Buddhism, but modern spirituality, and which sort of spills over into some forms of modern Buddhism. And I think a little reflection should be enough to show that these two points of view, in a sense, can easily go over to extremes. And the extreme of asceticism can often become And they use the word life-denying, mortifying the body. It can turn into a callousness, a sense of disconnection, which I think we sensed when we were discussing the Bhakkhula Sutta yesterday. It's almost slightly robotic insensitivity and selfishness. Because after all, samsara is just crap, so why care about it? Why care about unenlightened beings? They're just suffering anyway. Why care whether the climate's going to be destroyed? Well, you know, the Buddha said everything's impermanent, so you know, it's going to come to an end anyway. Why try to protest against war? Because, you know, war always happens and conflict's going to happen unless people get enlightened, then there's no hope in stopping war. There's this kind of mode of thought which becomes so focused on those spiritual ideals. Of course, the spiritual ideals are perfectly fine in themselves, but it becomes focused on those ideals neglecting the actual reality of what's happening around, neglecting the actual reality of human beings, who they are, where they are, in their complexity and their suffering. And on the other hand, the other tendency, the integrative tendency, can also become an extreme because, the obvious problem there is that there's simply no, doesn't actually impel you to change anything or to do anything. You can use a lot of fancy words to develop a philosophy about how you're so integrative and how, you know, you're not, how you're applying everything and everything's part of one and everything's spiritual and so on, these things. But at the end of the day, you're just actually living the Dhamma is not changing anything. Everything's just kind of being drawn back and accepted so that there's no dynamic there anymore. There's no push. There's no feeling that actually this is something that needs to be practiced. This is something that needs to be urgently done to overcome this form of suffering. And so this is an extreme also which the integrative approach can fall into. And so it's something which I believe that each person in a sense has to deal with, not just Buddhists and not just monastics, but I think all of us, all as human beings, when we reach a certain level of maturity in our lives, we're faced with these kinds of problems, this tension between, if you like, a higher calling and the more material, more immediate concerns of life. And all of us as human beings are going to have to find some way of making sense of that with what we have, with who we are, with the situation, with the context that we find ourselves in. And in a monastery this is no less the case. It certainly is not the case that when you become a monastic that somehow you make your choice as to one or the other of those things. I mean, this is how it's perceived from the outside. So from the outside, if you look at, say, the fourfold assembly, you have the ordained Sangha, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis and the lay people, and the ordained Sangha is the ones who've taken that spiritual path where the lay people have taken the worldly path. That's the convention. But, of course, the reality is very different. The reality, of course, is that there are many lay people who are very fine spiritual practitioners with very good meditation and very pure minds and so on and so forth. And, of course, within the monastic community you find also a diversity of people with different, both wholesome and unwholesome, and different kinds of aspirations and so on. So that external idea doesn't reflect very well the reality of what life is actually like on the inside. So that external, that idea is something which functions as a convention in a society, and like all conventions, it has a certain place, it has a certain role to help people to get along and to function and so on. But even in monastic life, we're constantly being faced with these kinds of choices, aren't we? Yeah? So the choice is, do we go shopping to Bunnings to get some stuff? Or do we go back to the monastery and go and stay in our kuti? And of course, there's no right and wrong. Okay, sometimes stuff needs to be got, and sometimes kutis need to be gone to. So there's no one thing is right and one thing is wrong about that. But what there is, or what there should be, is a sense of direction, a sense of purpose, and a sense of reflection about those things. So if the time comes for going back to your kuti, then, or going into seclusion, not your kuti or your whatever, your caravan or your cave or your room or whatever it is, and you go into seclusion, then you should reflect and say, well, I have this opportunity to go into seclusion. It's a very precious opportunity. So please reflect on this. It's actually very unusual in this world to have the chance to be in seclusion. There's a lot of people who are in seclusion or who are just lonely. Yeah, they don't have anybody. But that's not the case in the monastery. In the monastery, there are people around. You can always find somebody to chat with if you really want to. So you don't go to the kuti just because you're lonely, just because you haven't got anything else to do. You go to the kuti to seclusion because that's what your aspiration is. This is what we're here to do. And when we go into seclusion, spend our time well in seclusion. Meditation, quiet contemplation, study of the Dhamma, practicing a chanting, practicing mindfulness. We can never do too much of that. Just the simple practices, just sit there in your heart or whatever and just practice picking up a cup. Just sit there, don't do anything. Just, can I pick up a cup, put it to my mouth, sip the water and put it down again with perfect mindfulness. And keep on practicing that until you can do it. So practice, apply yourself to suttas, to understanding what it is that the Buddha was teaching. Practice and apply yourself to meditation. Experience what these things are all about. What does peace of mind mean? What does rapture mean? What does tranquility mean? What is insight? What are the different stages of insight? Practice and realize these things. Keep going until you can experience what is animitta like. What is it like to have your mind filled with light and joy and bliss? Don't accept mediocrity in your meditation. Bring a sense of care, quality and refinement to your meditation and to everything that you do. Experience these things that the Buddha was talking about for yourselves. And in that way, when you're in seclusion, you'll be performing a wonderful service for the community. Remember in the Chulagasinga Sutta, when the Buddha spoke of the three monks, Anuruddha, Kimbila and Nandiya, who were staying by themselves in seclusion, and he said that if the people around in that area were to recollect those clansmen practicing and putting forth effort, then that would be long for their happiness and well-being. So even just to think and reflect on that is something that gives rise to joy and to happiness. And that joy and that happiness that other people have, knowing that there are people who are trying to practice the Dhamma. You know, most people don't actually care or know how successful that you might be in your practice. They don't know whether you've got a good meditation or a bad meditation, and they don't really care either. What most people like to think about or like to think or like to know is that there are people who are trying, people who are sincere. So reflect on that, just to think about, you know, whenever you put forth effort, just to try a little bit harder and a little bit more, go a little bit further, and then over time that'll be a source of much joy and gratitude for many people. And so similarly also when we have to do things, when we have to do our chores, we bring the attitude of Dhamma into that. So in the monastery we don't have a lot of the pressures and tensions which often people have when they're working. We don't have KPIs, key performance indexes. We don't have deadlines. We don't pressure people into doing jobs or insist that they do jobs even if they don't want to and so on. We're very gentle in the way that we do these things. We take our time. And so the work is usually quite light. Unless somebody wants to work hard, then work is usually quite light. So don't take that as an opportunity to just be kind of slack and disorganized and distracted. When you do the work, apply yourself to the work 100%. When the chores are given out, you go off and you do that job. Don't do anything else. Do the job that you've been given. Don't get distracted into too much chatting and so on. My yoga teacher used to say, short stories are okay, life stories are not. So a bit of friendly conversation is fine, but don't spend your time talking away when you should be working. That's a sign of somebody who's not mindful. So somebody who's mindful, who has clear comprehension, understands what it is that the job they have to do, they understand what it is that they need to do to accomplish it, they understand what materials, what techniques, what assistance that they need. They understand how the progress of the job goes and they understand what job is finished. So bring this kind of attitude to what you're doing. Make sure that you're clear, constructive, effective in how you're doing things. Watch people who are good at their job and copy them. So this is one aspect of that more kind of engaged aspect of things, that worldly or that lower aspect, that movement of movement down and back into the world. And it comes out when dana comes, when we have visitors. So we greet the visitors with kindness and with respect and try to make their stay here a pleasant one. If we see things that need doing in the monastery, something that needs sweeping up or dishes that need washing, we don't whinge or complain about why somebody else hasn't done that, we just do it. You shouldn't need to be told to do these things. So, I don't like the word worldly. Actually, the best word is the word profane, but it's just a bit unusual. But anyway, let's say worldly things that we do, and these are just a few examples of them. When we do them, we bring that attitude of Dhamma into them, so that we do them as best we can as part of our spiritual practice. And that's our chance to develop compassion. It's our chance to reflect on the fact that our physical bodies are dependent on food. So, besata ahara pitika, all beings are sustained by food, is one of the reflections of the Buddha. So all of these little acts of kindness and generosity, and big acts of kindness and generosity, that sustain us and keep us going and allow us to do the things that we do in the monastery. So we develop the sense of appreciation for all of these things. It doesn't just happen, it's something we have to develop. We keep on reflecting on it. Reflect at the meal time, reflect at the breakfast time. This is something we're taking as nutriment for the body to keep us going, to sustain us through the day. And if we bring that sense of care and respect into those lower realms, then they will help to support those higher levels of development. One of the concerns, in fact probably the main concern I have with a text like the Bakula Sutta is that, without passing judgment on Venerable Bakula, who he was or how he practiced and so on, but I think for most people, or many people, when they see that, can often grasp the wrong end of the stick. And I'm speaking from experience here, even though yesterday when we gave the sutta class, you heard me being somewhat critical of that text in many ways. But actually, when I was a young monk and when I first read that text, I was very inspired by it. And I was really inspired by that kind of ideal of monastic life. I perhaps didn't think it through all that clearly as to what it meant, because, never basically helping anybody or doing anything for anybody. But the kind of the aloofness of it, the disinterestedness of it, and so on, I found to be quite inspiring. And looking back at that now, it seems to me that there was a certain aspect of that which was quite wholesome. That when I came to monastic life and I wanted to become a monk, there's a certain need that we have to separate, to differentiate, to propel ourselves out of that worldly life. There needs to be a certain force there to push us out from the worldly concerns and worldly ways of thinking and doing things. So part of that, I think, was quite wholesome and probably quite essential. But also I think part of it was tapping into more negative or destructive aspects of my own personality. A sense of dismissiveness, a sense of sort of disdain for the world, disdain for those things which are lesser, which happen to be most other people and things, a sense of contempt. So there was these kind of quite negative emotions which also can be fueled by that kind of text or that kind of way of seeing things. So the more that I've grown up or progressed in monastic life, the less I've tended to see these things as being contradictions. That I've more kind of appreciated the dynamics of these kind of flow, the times in retreat, the times out of retreat, the times in the monastery, the times out of the monastery, the time for practice, the time for work, and so on and so forth. And you see these things not as, there's no more contradiction between them than there is a contradiction between day and night, or a contradiction between winter and summer. They're just part of the natural flow of things. And if we get too stuck on them, we're going to suffer. If we become too attached to that spiritual way of being as monastics and too disconnected from the world, we can become quite dysfunctional human beings. We can become human beings who don't know how to cope, who don't know how to deal with people, who feel a sense of entitlement, who feel that somehow the world owes us dana every day. The universe owes us a nice kuti to stay in. The universe owes us the things that we need, rather than realizing that actually the universe doesn't owe you anything at all. No one owes you anything. And everything that you get is a bonus. So I think this is really important to remember. Whatever we get, it's like a gift. Well, it's not like a gift, it is a gift. So it's like we live on Christmas presents for the whole year. Nobody owes us anything. So if we get trapped in that kind of way of being, we can also our holy life becomes very fragile when the conditions that we need or that we feel that we're entitled to are not there anymore. When something goes wrong, we can't cope. And I've seen this happen to quite a few monks that I know. They just end up not being able to cope when something happens. They end up drifting or disrobing. They never learned. All they've learned as monks is to sit still and to walk up and down. So during our time as monastics, remember and think of this as being a lifelong vocation. if we're monastics for many years, then during that time we will have the chance to do many different things. We will have the chance to spend time in seclusion practicing meditation. We'll have the chance to spend time studying. We'll have the chance to spend time serving others in different ways. We'll have the chance to, if we wish, we have the chance to teach and to help others. And these things are all good things. They're all things that we should approach with a good heart and a willing spirit. Try it out and see. Give it your best. No one did anything great ever by being kind of uninterested and cynical and negative about anything. That never created anything good in the world. The great things, all the good things that have come in the world, have come from a sense of passion, a sense of excitement, a sense of wonder. These things create great things in the world. And if we bring that kind of attitude, then we'll find that not only do we accomplish good things for ourselves and for others, but we bring a sense of inspiration into our lives, which will be a wonderful fuel and support for our meditation. So this is just a few reflections for this evening on those aspects of the ideas and principles which were evoked or thrown up in the discussion of the Bakula Sutta yesterday. So I offer these for your reflection, and I'd like to invite a visitor.